This is Jenny Garth from 90210 OMG. Let's be honest, the 90s gave us some great things. The music, totally rad. The fashion, so fly. Home decor, that's a different story. In HGTV's new competition series, Totally 90s House, two teams of iconic TV stars take on two homes frozen in time. Paired with HGTV experts, they'll turn dated spaces into fresh, modern homes and compete for the ultimate bragging rights. Goodbye, honeyoak cabinets. Hello, 21st century style. Totally 90s House special series premiere starts August 26th at 9, 8 Central on HGTV.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Thank you once again to everyone who is listening on Tuesday for helping to keep this thing afloat. And as a reminder, if you don't subscribe, and thus you don't get access to the private ad-free RSS feed offered by Substack, you can always go sign up for the public RSS feed that goes live on Wednesday mornings at, I think, 8:30 Eastern time is when that goes up. Yeah, it has ads. It goes up a day later. But ads, that helps keep the lights on here, too. So, you know, you can watch it here on Substack for free. But you can't get the RSS, I don't think, unless you're a subscriber. And, you know, I know people like convenience. So you can pick it up at Apple or wherever else fine podcasts are found. And you can listen that way as well. And now on to controversies and non-controversies, where One Night Only director Will Gluck has some thoughts on Gen Z and Gen Alpha's discomfort with nudity. We're going to discuss One Night Only a little more thoroughly in a minute. Suffice to say that for a premise as raunchy as The Purge, but for 12 hours, all extramarital sex is legal instead of being banned. It's been banned for some, neither here nor there. Point is, sex, legal, people doing it everywhere. It's a weirdly chaste movie. Lots of people in lingerie and revealing dresses, very little, no actual nudity. And this is from a Q&A in Variety with Gluck. Recent studies have found that Gen Z and Gen Alpha don't want to see sex on screen. Was that a concern while making this movie? And the director answers, the answer is 100% yes. I went through this on two movies. I have long pages of empirical data about it. The only thing is I don't think it's just Gen Z and Gen Alpha. I believe it's been a societal shift from taking nudity in adult situations and putting them on your phones at home for everyone. Now it's more of a private, intimate thing that people don't want to see when they're in a shared experience. Whenever people now see nudity or very adult situations in a big theater, they get uncomfortable, end quote. You hear about this sort of thing a fair amount in the world of filmmaking, about both generational discomfort and discomfort more broadly, as Gluck gets at here, with sex and nudity. It's not always the case. The Housemaid, for instance, had a pretty steamy sex scene. That was a huge hit. You know, nobody was skipping The Housemaid because it had Sydney Sweeney naked. But nudity is notably absent from certain films where 20 years ago it would have been pretty much de rigueur, right? Like this year's Obsession, for instance, huge hit. It's a movie that would have had a perfectly good reason for lots of nudity. And it had almost none. There's like a mutilated body kind of late in the film that's very obviously a lifelike dummy. But to feature nudity in that film would only have made an already awkward situation filled with awkward conversations about consent and the such in that movie even more awkward. And I think one reason that movie succeeded because it wasn't awkward. It was comically awkward, but it wasn't awkward. I'm kind of fascinated by this trend, frankly. It's totally foreign to how I watched movies growing up. And I think part of this has to do with the rise of pornography. Obviously, you don't need to go to a theater to see hot naked people anymore. But also in changing mores about presentations of nudity, right? What is the modern sin of what's the worst thing you can do in modern times? Maybe not the worst thing. What's one of the worst things you can do in modern times, right? Is send an
genocide?
Unwanted dick pic. I'm trying to decide how bad this is, frankly, in my head as I'm going. But sending somebody an unwanted dick pic is like tantamount to sexual assault in certain ways. Like that's kind of how it is treated. And I think people have been trained to see unexpected nudity as a violation of sorts, which is maybe a social positive, right? I don't know. Maybe it's good for the world that that's the case. But it's almost certainly an artistic negative. And I'm sorry, I always get taken out of these movies when I start noticing all the people having bra sex, like people having sex with all their clothes on. Like, that's just not how people have sex. I'm sorry. That's not how it works. Peter, what's the deal here? What's your read on what's going on with all of this? I don't know. Maybe you're a closed sex on person. Am I discriminating against closed sexers in this podcast?
This is why you have to subscribe, be a paid subscribe people, subscriber yeah. people. Like,
I gotta make sure to keep the free preview right up and up through closed sexers. That's the cutoff point. All right.
Yes.
I think we need an MPAA rating on this episode. This is very much the R-rated version. I know I was just surprised that you were apologizing for the fact that people sometimes have sex without their clothes on. You're like, I'm sorry. That's the way it, right? Does it need an apology?
I'm sorry. It's not how it happens. That's not what happens. I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe I'm wrong.
I was just struck by this interview because, as you said, it's so different from the world, the cinematic world that we grew up in which nudity was both expected and a selling point. And it was, and there was a kind of interesting way in which it was a selling point that was, that like sometimes they would pretend wasn't one, but very clearly was. And if you ever read any kind of like behind the scenes Hollywood, the producers were just like, yep, we're putting some tits on in this movie, right? And like that, like it was totally vulgar, totally just like we're treating, especially women's bodies as like, this is what you're paying to see. Right.
And yeah, and certainly that has always been like, it is unidirectional, right? I mean, when we went back and I watched Roadhouse for the first time, there are just a ton of scenes in there that are just like tits. Like, this is just here for the tits. But there's never been an equivalent where men's bodies were treated the same way. Like, that has never been treated as like a selling point to women. It's never been sort of a cinematic equivalent. It's just not.
So I totally agree that it's never been a complete equivalent. But I would say in response to that, two things. One is during the 80s, 90s sort of peak of the erotic thriller when, it wasn't just that rom-coms, that R-rated adult rom-coms had nudity. It was actually even more so that the erotic thrillers, the sexy movies that were also kind of dangerous and violent, right? Brian De Palma directed a bunch of them, but also there were a lot by, the Adrian Lyne films. I mean, like, but there were a lot by even directors who were kind of journeymen because it's just a standard, sort of a studio programmer type that was made by a bunch of times every year, right? And that has just totally fallen away. You basically don't even see erotic thrillers in theaters anymore. You sometimes see them, on television, things like Presumed Innocence doesn't quite count, but gets us closer. It's more of a courtroom thriller, but gets us a little closer than we have seen in the theaters for the past couple of years. But there was at that time, Alyssa, an undercurrent of we're going to show male nudity for both titillation and artistic purposes in the sort of upper end of the art house circuit. And there's always this attempt to make it a thing that happened. And then it's like you couldn't draw female. Like, look, it was not that difficult to draw out male viewers for the promise of here is a young starlet's breasts in the 1980s. And like that was, even if that wasn't the explicit promise, even if it was just sort of word got around, right? This movie's rated R. What's it rated R for? Nudity. Right? Like this was, and again, like I'm talking about this sort of jokingly and like very directly, but that's because if you have encountered any journalism about Hollywood in the 80s and 90s, the mostly male producer class of that era, the studio moguls, the directors spoke about this
like that openly and that bluntly amongst themselves. They understood exactly what they were doing. But the other thing that I would push back on just a little tiny bit, and I wonder actually how you feel about this, because I wouldn't have thought of this maybe until, I don't know, 2 seconds ago. New thought popping in my head on air. It does seem to me like in the past 15 years, although yes, we have seen many, many, many fewer romantic comedies, as we have like entered the superhero era, and that has, and male body image standards have changed quite a bit for Hollywood stars. Even for, and maybe even in some ways, especially for some of the older male stars, but particularly for young guys, right? Like there, it does seem to me like there has been a renewed, increased emphasis on you get the shirt off shot, right? And this, it's not that like male stars didn't take their shirts off and we didn't get to see their sort of, their pool bodies in the 1980s. And sometimes there were even, right, like there's the, the mustache guy, he's in Boogie Nights, the actor, Burt Reynolds? Right, like he had a sort of particular type, mustache, like when he was younger, right, had a particular type of physique that is not like today's physiques, but like was at least said to have an appeal to it. But now there is this thing where it's like these guys have worked on their bodies so much. I almost wonder if they want to make sure that it's in there, right? If it's like, yeah, this is like my every single waking hour devoted to thinking about this. Like, because you don't get a physique like that unless you are just absolutely super rigorous about your eating and your drinking. And you even see this in like The Odyssey, which is not a prurient movie, but like Matt Damon is shirtless in a way that is a little bit designed to tell you he is in his mid-50s and boy, he has been keeping up with it.
In the words of Emily Wilson, there are no sex scenes and all the food looks horrible. Maybe those two things are connected. No, I think what you're noodling around is something that there's a difference between nudity and sex scenes, right? And yeah, I think that's for sure. Actually a really important distinction to draw. So like, a topless pool party scene or like a topless dancing in a bar scene in Roadhouse is sort of the equivalent of the shirt off scene. It's like, Chris Evans as Captain America, having a shirt off at some point when a neighbor comes by or whatever. But those aren't sex scenes, right? They're scenes of, they're sort of depictions of bodies that are in and of themselves meant to be titillating, but they're not actually sex scenes. And, I think that it is interesting to think about the difference between those two things, because I don't know necessarily that audiences today would object to something like the sex scenes in the 1999 remake of The Thomas Crown Affair, right? Where both Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo are like pretty naked in a lot of those scenes. I don't think there's like an actual shot of like anybody's genitalia, but like otherwise they're quite naked. The sex scenes are quite explicit, right? Like there's like they are full on like ongoing penetration, but there are also people like laughing and hanging out afterwards and like hanging around sort of half dressed or naked. Like there's this sense of build up to act to sort of a comfort afterwards. And, that movie came out when I was 15. And I remember thinking like, oh, okay, like this is what people are talking about. This is why, people think sex is fun and interesting. Like it was a full, you saw it, it was not just like bodies. It was a relationship that was being built and expressed through the union of those two bodies.
Well, that movie also specifically was just noted at the time for the fact that Rene Russo was in her mid-40s when it came out. And that it was, right, that she looked great, but it was somewhat seen as somewhat daring, that the sort of the, like we talked about, what I was talking about earlier sort of was the producer's idea of the ideal kind of get the butts in seats sex scene had a young woman.
Yeah. And she clearly doesn't have implants, or if she does, they're like very subtle. Like she's a woman who is allowed to be like naked and look her age. And what's hot about those scenes is not the specifics of people's bodies, but what they're doing with their bodies to each other and together. And, I think that, those two things are different. We don't seem to have a good vocabulary to talk about them. It's also interesting that this is theoretically declined at a time when a lot of women are reading like fairly steamy, explicit fiction, right? Yeah. And so you have this rise in sort of a clear female audience for sex scenes that are not being put on screen, at least with the sort of degree of explicitness that they're written in text. And then directors making these sort of very sweeping judgments about what an entire generation wants. And so I think there are just a lot of things that are sort of tangled up in here, right? I mean, Sunny, I totally, like, yes, I would prefer not to receive unsolicited pictures of people's genitalia. But if I, like, have a sense that a movie is, you know, meant to be about an erotic relationship, I don't think I would find that disconcerting. I actually think it would be weirder if there wasn't a sex scene, right? And I do think that's one of the things that comes across as, like, sort of interesting about One Night Only, which I think does like an interesting job of depicting people in the sort of comfortable aftermath of sex, but is very uncomfortable with the idea of depicting people actually having sex.
So if I understand correctly, I believe there were scenes with of nudity that were cut.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's what Gluck says later in the interview. I mean, I think it's worth pointing, again, like going back to the example of The Housemaid, right? So The Housemaid is a movie that is basically, it's women's literature, right? It's like a trashy airport novel aimed at women. And that movie did have nudity. That movie had, you know, that movie had like a real proper sex scene. And it's interesting that that is the one at which, and also like the audience for that movie, I think was something like 70% female in the audience polling. I mean, it was, that was a movie.
I'm surprised it's that low.
I honestly
didn't look it up before we just...
Before we started the show. But, you know, again, that to your point, that I think that there is maybe an audience for it in a very specific sort of movie. But again, I like it's that sort of, you know, for lack of a better delineation here, the sort of like Porky's, Animal House, you know, Meatballs, up to American Pie. You know, that generation of film, and you see it starting to go away, you know, even earlier than what we're talking about now. Like Superbad had no there was no sex scene in Superbad, a movie that is about kids trying to have sex before they go to college, and was like super chaste. Like there was nothing in that.
Although there was pretty aggressive nudity, not so much sex, but nudity in No Hard Feelings with Jennifer Lawrence. And this was, you know, something I think she talked about. If I recall, I could be confusing her with another actress, but I believe like one of the things she talked about around that movie's release was, look, I'm going to get older. I want to do this now while I still feel like I look great.
Yeah.
I may be botching the quote somewhat there, but like that was the general idea.
But again, also like that was a scene that was done for comic effect, right? It wasn't, yes. It was more like the scene in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, right? Like that's a movie that had nudity, but it had comic male nudity, you know, instead of titillating nudity. And that's really what it comes down to, right? Is like the end of titillation. Like there's a what feels like a fairly concerted effort to reduce titillation. And again, like I feel like that's not necessarily a bad thing, except it kind of can be. It can be distracting. It can be noticeably chaste, and that is, I think that's detrimental to the film, the films themselves. But
well, there's sort of two things going on here. One is if pure titillation, right, visual stimulation, right, from what you're seeing on screen is the main goal of what you're doing, then there's just no way for any reasonably produced Hollywood drama, comedy, whatever, to compete with internet pornography, right? There's just like, it's internet pornography will show you absolutely anything you want, like that you could imagine, right? Like bra sex or not, Sonny, right? Like you can find people doing crazy stuff, totally crazy stuff, right? And it's just totally, it's infinite and it's available on your phone right now, right? And there's just no way to compete with infinite free titillation that goes much, much further and is much more kind of directed explicitly, right? This is just a sort of like, so just in kind of a like a purity kind of like, you're not going to like at some point, like the pure heroin is going to outcompete the other stuff because it's just like it does the job, right?
Well, that's not to mention AI and OnlyFans, right? I mean, the ability to essentially order personalized pornography is, you know, means that movies don't have to be the only source of that. But that said, yeah, like if you want to depict, if you want to tell a story about like two adults who have a strong sexual connection, it's weird to not be able to express that on screen, right? It's
well, this like, is, this, or, yeah, this is the thing that I, the other thing I was thinking is, right, there is this, I think it's in Vulture a couple of years ago, I was sort of complaint about the superhero era where everyone's hot and no one is horny. But this is the thing that is gone, that you're, that like we have in some sense lost with the loss of the erotic thriller and the, you know, nude sex scene in a rom-com is that physical, like that sense of physical connection. And I think that Gen Z, sure, there's the, like, again, there's the kind of porn is heroin versus, you know, the softer stuff, competition effect. But there's also this thing that I do think is real, which is that Gen Z, younger viewers are quite uncomfortable with public displays of horniness, right? Of but like of real meaningful. I don't mean just sort of like kind of lecherous, like lusty, right? But like a, like people get like physically interested in their romantic partners or, you know, or objects of romantic affection. And that depictions of that have been very, very few and far between since, I don't know, 2009 or so.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, I think at a certain point, nudity on screen became so firmly identified with internet pornography that it just like it now feels wrong to have nudity on screen in most other situations. And there have been spillover effects from this, right? Like what was the big knock on the first couple seasons of Game of Thrones was too much sex. They're just talking and everybody's nudity. There's everybody's naked and what's the sex position nonsense? You know, this is unbecoming. And then the show got really boring because they were like, well, I guess we can't do that anymore. So, you know, there's real trade-offs. All right.
In the 90s, I didn't have HBO, right? But we would get the free HBO weekends. And something that I distinctly remember as a teenage boy, among other things, was that they would have ads on these free HBO weekends where explicitly they'd be like, on HBO, we can show you anything, right? Violence, you could say any word you want. There's a lot of nudity. Like they'd have a guy basically looking at the camera saying, subscribe to HBO, lots of nudity.
Different times. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that filmgoers hate sexy times at the movies? Peter.
It's a little bit of a controversy. Like, physical sexual connection is a real part of human relationships. Kind of seems like it has disappeared even from adult storytelling, visual storytelling.
Alyssa.
It's a controversy. People deserve more than just like weird novels about fairy sex.
It's a non-controversy, and this is the great and godly first step towards our nation in which the sex purge will become the law of the land. We'll get to that in a second. Make sure to swing by Thursday for our bonus episode on the decline of the critic columnist with Ross Douthat leaving the New York Times. There are roughly no op-ed columnists who can also do double duty in the cultural political space. That's a problem. We're going to talk to one of the OG cultural critics, one Alyssa Rosenberg. And we're going to lament the decline of this specific type of writing because it's what we do. And that's sad for us, really, as much as anything else. And now on to the main event.
Hey, everybody. Lady Luck here. And we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
One night only. It's one of the rare, genuinely reactionary big studio movies released every year, which really helps explain why this
I got to be honest, I think very charming rom-com with a stellar cast of critical favorites. People, like, not too long ago were raving about Monica Barbaro and Callum Turner and how great they are and all, you know. And this movie's like 40% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. And I was kind of surprised coming out. But look, here's the thing. I am one of the few conservative film critics, never Trumper notwithstanding. But for the most part, I don't think film critics let themselves get too tripped up by ideology, except in one very specific way, or at least in one very specific way, they don't get tripped up, right? They don't fawn over bad progressive narrative features, right? Like, so a movie like Don't Look Up, which is this climate change allegory that got nominated for Best Picture, despite being rotten on Rotten Tomatoes, right? Like, that's the sort of movie that doesn't really pass muster with critics. They can see through it. So again, for the most part, ideology doesn't enter into it all that often, but that's at least because in part, so few films are genuinely actually like pretty reactionary minded, let's say. I would not describe this film as intentionally reactionary, but there's a not so esoteric case to be made. Anyway, the point is, critics not too often tasked with wrestling with something that's terribly far outside their comfort zone. And as I said, like, One Night Only is like reactionary, like J.D. Vance bans premarital sex in the country and it shows how this will help people fall in love reactionary. Like, it actively mocks the people who want to hook up on sex purge night reactionary. Like, the main character works in a pizza shop named after the Claremont Institute. Guys, it's the Claremont Pizza. It's Claremont Pizza. These are things that, like, if you hear the dog whistles, you can't stop hearing them. It's a pretty reactionary movie, is what I'm saying. And you could just see it scanning through some of the negative reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, right? Like, Roger Ebert's critic gave it 0 stars because it is, quote, everything that's troubling about the current conservative capitalist hellscape that is the United States of America writ large, end quote. Another critic slammed it for being weirdly, creepily conservative. Here are some other choice words from reviews. Regressive, wrong place and time, morally dubious, etc. I could go on, but hopefully you get the scoldy drift. Anyway, again, as a reactionary myself, albeit not really one of the socially conservative stripe, my joke before about this being a controversy notwithstanding, I was able to set aside and appreciate this movie for what it is. It's funny, sweet, competent two-hander with two absurdly attractive leads and just enough laughs to keep the action moving and some, like, nice little running bits. I enjoyed it. The premise here is pretty straightforward. 3 years ago, the evil social conservatives did The Purge, but for sex, right? Remember The Purge? The Purge is that movie where for one day per year, for 12 hours, all crime is legal. You can commit murders or robberies or whatever, and you don't get punished for it. On sex purge night, everybody tries to get laid for 12 hours, some with more success than others. Indeed, one of the running silent jokes of this movie is you keep seeing Callum Turner, like, walking on the street by himself and these ridiculously hot women, like, turning their heads at him, like, what? He's alone in all of his, you know, James Bond-esque glory, just striding down the street. The least believable plot point in this film about a fascist government establishing a law that makes extramarital sex illegal is that Monica Barbaro would have trouble finding someone to be with on the night. But, you know, you make allowances for plot mechanics, I guess. This is you gotta have the willing suspension of disbelief. Anyway, what follows is a series of misadventures that take our heroes all over New York City as they kind of mouth protests against the fascist implications of sex purge night until they inevitably meet up in the pizza shop named after the home of the West Coast Straussians, and fall in love and decide not to have sex. They decide that waiting is better after all, turns out. The fascists were right. It's a cute little movie with a number of, like I said, funny running gags, like Barbaro's character's name is Allie. She sings covers of pop songs for prescription medications, like plaque psoriasis, which just, like, cracked me up. Throughout, there's all of these references to actual brands in the movie that have taken advantage of sex purge night to, you know, charge more for things or, like, get people hyped up. And it's funny, in the interview I referenced earlier, the director said that, you know, they had to go to these companies and ask permission. Like, everybody thinks this movie has tons of product placement. Indeed, that's what I thought. I texted you guys. I was like, so much product placement in this. But they had to, they asked permission. They didn't charge people to be in this movie. It was like a they had to get permission for Dunkin' Donuts to be involved in Sex Purge Night, for instance, which is pretty funny. Anyway, I like this movie. I like this movie, but I am the reactionary on this podcast. Alyssa, you're a good normie liberal. What did you make of One Night Only, a.k.a. The Sex Purge?
I really enjoyed this. And I think that the reason that some lefty critics are reacting to it the way they are is that because the underlying political argument is that if government and big tech, you know, teamed up to do something unbelievably invasive, most people would just roll over for it, right? Like there is, it, this movie has no like underground, like sex criminal resistance, right? Like there is not, you know, there is not clearly like some group of people with like throwing wild underground sex parties. Like everyone has just gone along with it. They've gotten their stupid little wrist tattoos. They complain about it. They may like maybe host some benefit concerts about it, but like, people are not like protesting.
They put up a little sign in their shop window. It's kind of cute and maybe has like something that looks a little bit like a rainbow. Is, like,
this movie. The movie, you're right, Alyssa, it captures that idea of slacktivism perfectly. It's like, what's the most people would do? They'd quietly complain and then go along with it, really?
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, there is a very funny bit about, you know, there's this guy who Monica Barbaro is about to hook up with when the police show up. And initially it seems like he's just broken the laws about Sex Purge Night a bunch of times, but also he's just like a habitual criminal, right? Like he's someone, there is not like, there's, you know, not some movement of people who are like having extramarital sex en masse in like Times Square to protest this and are like taking the consequences from the government. Like, everyone has just given in and surrendered. They've surrendered, and they've surrendered to the government, and they've surrendered to the tech companies. And there is an excellent joke where it becomes clear one of the people that Monica Barbaro is flirting with in a bar is Cousin Greg from Succession, who works for the tech company that implemented the tattoos and is now working on a product that will allow people to suppress their dopamine and circumvent the monitoring on the tattoos. And it is perfectly cynical. It is just absolutely terrific, right? The pop star who is sort of ostensibly leading the, you know, fuck the mandate resistance, it's just a complete jackass. You know, he is a ridiculous human being. And so, look, I think that
he's not just a jackass. At one point, he says maybe the fascists were right, that like the sex purge is actually a good idea, that it has made sex and relationships like more appealing. It's amazing.
And so I think a lot of the reaction to this movie is a desire not to recognize oneself in the caricature. And you know, it took me a little while to sort of glom onto the fact that that was something that I liked about this movie, that it was just, you know, it punctures the inflated self-regard of people who are holding on to the sort of banner of the resistance without actually doing very much about it. And I thought that was a hoot.
Can I just pull the curtain back for a second? Because before we were trying to decide what we were going to do this week, and Alyssa, you were like, this is getting really bad reviews.
Yeah,
I was wrong. I don't know if we should do it. Maybe there's something else we could do. And I was like, I had scanned the reviews. I had seen some of them come in. A friend of the pod, Akash, had actually tagged me on a tweet. He was like, hey, Sonny, this is going to be your favorite movie of the year, highlighting some of the negative ones. I was like, ooh, interesting. And I was like, I really feel like it is true that this movie is being hammered for straight up, pretty straightforwardly ideological reasons that don't correspond to what's in the film.
Yeah. And look, I do. I also think this is a movie that it's a one crazy night movie, right? And so much of those movies depends on whether or not you find the gags and the specifics of the craziness effective. And look, it may not work for everybody. I found the running gags quite funny, right? I mean, having, you know, Calum Turner's character's parent, like his mom is Molly Ringwald. So the sort of, you know, archetype of the teen girl for people who are roughly our age. And then the boyfriend she's having just like weird asthma sex with is LeVar Burton, right? I mean, having LeVar Burton just like
LeVar Burton naked but wrapped in bubble wrap.
It took me 15 seconds. I was like, I know him for, oh my God.
Yep, the Reading Rainbow guy has clothespins on his nipples, right? I feel like this is a movie that is very specifically engineered to both appeal to and own people in our generation, right? Like, there's like a Buck Mason purchaser who is a co-host of this podcast who felt thoroughly, was sort of targeted by the running jokes about sort of Buck Mason as the kind of ultimate in certain, guys class of menswear. And there's other casting like that too, right? Casting the Sailor King Princess as Monica Bartali's friend who goes out intending to just like get down to clown and then ends up meeting like an actual prince in line for the bathroom. Like it's a funny movie. The obnoxious tween who is being babysat by Ali's roommate as a lesbian who's like, we've been getting around your laws for years, like you heterosexual people, like, whatever, do your the sort of gross running gag about like finding the last condom in New York City. I mean, it's a funny movie, and if you feel owned by the concept, like, sure, fine, whatever. But also look around at what's actually happening. We have a whole economy.
This is what gets me, is that I think people are reading this as a fundamentally conservative film. And I don't think there's some sort of conservative values like that sort of come through in certain ways, depending on how you want to read it. But this movie to me read as like, when the fascism comes, people are just going to shrug. They'll put up their little side and go along with their lives. And you know what? The other thing that's going to happen is brands are going to adjust their marketing and try and sell you something. Like, this is a movie that is like a critique of capitalism, that is a critique of fascism is literally here. And guess what you're doing? You're trying to figure out what you're going to wear to your date at Dante, right? Like, it is precisely targeted this is not a movie that I think sort of takes this stuff in a way that is blasé or it doesn't take it unseriously itself. What it does is it says that our society wouldn't take it seriously if it descended upon us. And I think it is quite like, it's not that much of a leap from there to see in this movie an argument that, in fact, this sort of thing is descending upon us already. As a libertarian, I look at this and I think about things like the drug war. I think about things like, some of the COVID mandates, which, yes, there was resistance, and especially in sort of more red states. But look at how how that stuff was followed, even some of the sillier and weirder stuff in blue states, where it became a kind of, in some cases, more like a religion, but certainly just something like you just did it and you didn't question it, even if you were kind of grumbling about it. And that's this movie's position here politically is, yeah, you know what? If they did the fascism, people would kind of shrug their shoulders and then try to make a buck.
What did you make of the movie otherwise, Peter? Did you find it funny? Was it amusing?
It's quite well executed.
Were you titillated?
It's quite well executed in a bunch of ways. I don't think I quite loved it. My mixed reaction comes from the fact that what I loved about this movie was the world building. This is a rare romantic comedy that has a essentially science fictional world. Now, it's a science fictional world that very much looks and feels like our own, but it is a science fictional world, and it took the world building aspect really seriously. All of these kind of government signs, like with the fine print about how it's specifically from the Department of Health and Human Services, right? We talked about the resistance signs, but like all of the particular ways in which the brands, Equinox, Equinox isn't mad about this. Equinox still just wants your money. And so what are they going to say? They're going to say, get your body really hot for the one night of year, right? Like this, it's perfect. It's so perfect. And yes, the Cousin Greg bit, I think, really kind of establishes that this is about, look, the reaction to this sort of thing is going to be is just going to be, oh, you the cousin Greg both helped invent the monitors and is also helping invent the product to defeat the monitors, right? He's just going to cash in either way. And that seems kind of right to me in a lot of ways. And I thought conceptually this movie was great. And then in terms of the romantic comedy aspect, it's pretty effective in terms of the way it hits all of the beats. But I kept wondering if a very straightforward, I mean, like the romantic comedy aspect, aside from the weird world that they live in, is actually very conventional. I mean, it's really by the book, you know, sort of, and it's not surprising from the guy who gave us Anyone But You, which another reasonably charming movie. I think I liked this one better. But I kept wondering if this movie would have been better if it were more about the world and less determined to be a, you know, note perfect romantic comedy. Because every time we explore the world of Sex Purge, it's fascinating. And then every time we get cute back and forth stuff between our two leads, right? Your legs look funny and you got a weird hairline. And is that Buck Mason? The Buck Mason joke is cute and running, but like these are, this stuff worked less well for me. I didn't think it was bad, but it felt a little bit like the world needs more romantic comedies. Let's give them generic, attractive people in New York romantic comedies. And this movie has such a compelling and interesting view on its world that I wanted maybe a movie that wasn't what the movie that they wanted to make. But like they've got sort of two things. They're not quite at odds with each other, but it's really stuffing a very conventional romantic comedy formula into this weird box. Kind of liked it, but I also felt like that maybe wasn't the very best choice.
So what you're saying is that you want the, I'm going to really torture a metaphor here, the Sex Purge version of Showdown at Gucci Gulch, which is this classic book about the passage of tax reform in 1986. You want to know like how Sex Purge came to happen, like, what are the cultural forces that
Peter wants the
very
prequel,
specifically and
the
exactly
first
want
sex
that
purge.
And, so let me one of my favorite sort of weird genre deconstructions is Cabin in the Woods. And part of what Cabin in the Woods does is it starts as a very conventional sort of teen horror thriller, and you can see that it's got some satirical elements, but it's playing it pretty straight right up until the point that it is, oh, we are not playing it straight. We are going back into the monster bureaucracy and like where you've got a bunch of guys with buttons watching screens and like and you get the lore and the backstory, and it like departs further and further while at the same time maintaining a very very classic three-act structure. I think the third act of that movie is really one of my favorites of all time. Just incredible. But these two things end up the weirdness of the kind of bureaucratic satire, right? Almost the office comedy with very conventional Wes Craven style teen horror in the woods comedy. They end up converging and colliding in some really fascinating ways. And I think that's sort of what I wanted more of here, is more of a kind of collision with like the dark heart of this world. I mean, you can even think of something like I'm just going to forget the guy who wrote the novel Conclave has also written all of these other novels that are these mystery thrillers, right? And I love, as I've said, mystery, you know, sort of everything should in some sense be a murder mystery, where they're set in a particular world. Pompeii is one of them. He wrote one, the one I'm thinking about that I can't remember the title of, set in Nazi Germany. And in every one of these stories, what you get is not just sort of somebody kind of skirting around the edges of this world, but that person ends up going into like the center of it, the dark heart of what makes this world tick. And this movie, because it's so determined to work like a romantic comedy, never has the characters really deeply encounter like the central sort of controlling, you know, like we don't get the scene in which they end up talking to the bureaucrat at HHS who is running all of this. We don't get the scene in which they have to argue with the senator who wanted this stuff passed, who we see on TV for briefly. I think it's a senator, right? Josh Hawley type.
You do get a little bit of that in the police station, right?
Where that's the closest you get. And that scene
and there's good and dark. And it also, they have Monique Jeffries playing the cop, who is in another nice bit of casting. starred on Law and Order Special Victims Unit in the early years of that show. And so it's like, it is a very funny sort of meta moment where it's like, this person who you probably know from reruns of the show, but she was investigating serious sex crimes, is now like enforcing the law on Sex Purge Night. And I mean, one thing that would be interesting, I don't, this movie is clearly not going to be successful enough to spawn a franchise like The Purge, but you could do a version of Sex Purge Night where it's like the first one's a romantic comedy. The next one is about like a cop who has to work on Sex Purge Night. Like you could do the sort of like the, you know, the first Sex Purge Night, et cetera. Like you could do, you know, something with like at the tech company. Yeah, I think you're probably right that like there is a concept that lends itself to a series of better movies in this. But this one's reasonably charming.
Thank you for seeing
the police station. Is great. I think is right in the middle of the movie, and in many ways, I think it's conceptually maybe the best sequence in the film, and in part because it brings our characters into contact with the system. And it allows us to see, oh, there are actually repeat offenders. It's not an organized resistance movement. It's just a dirty old man. It's actually very funny, right? You get, again, all of the signage and all of this, but like you see the system of enforcement, and you also see that, just among other things, the cops are as annoyed as everyone else is at having to enforce it, right? Making the kind of drug war metaphor there, if that's what you want to, how you want to see this, even clearer.
So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on One Night Only, aka Sex Purge Night? Peter.
Movie has some problems, but it's quite charming and conceptually pretty daring. Thumbs up.
Alyssa.
Thumbs up. And if you're a liberal or a lefty who feels indebted by this, watch the movie and then go buy Eitan Hersh's Politics is for Power and actually do something about the world.
I give this movie a thumbs up and endorse its view of the world and its proposed solutions to our romance crisis in America and the world. Let's go. Let's go, guys. Sex Purge Night coming up. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, if you, in fact, oppose Sex Purge Night for some reason, complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch, and I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.